Good morning. It is about 10 a.m. here, August 12th. That would be a Friday. Coming at you live here from beautiful Belgrade, Serbia. What is happening is unbelievable. The media push and the events that are lining up. These are hardly ever random, and often it's about trying to create the the news and what's connected to what. And you know, there's a common belief, it's often wrong, by the way, but there's a common belief that one news event is prepared to distract from another. That does happen, especially when you have competing narratives, and that does happen. But a lot of times events are just events. This week, this is a crazy set of things happening all at once, because you have the Ukrainian terrorist attack on this nuclear facility. You have the Obama FBI raiding the president's house, the Winter White House, and we have forgotten all about, of course, the Europeans haven't forgotten that they're about past due on solving this problem that they have with Russia. Well, they've created it for themselves in many ways. And how all these things line up at the same time. We heard recently from another person very close, what is it, in the defense, in the cabinet, from the cabinet of Zelensky, that all this talk about a counteroffensive in Kherson was completely made up. It was a psyop, he said. And people pointed out, no, the psyop isn't making you think that it's a psyop. They actually just... It doesn't work on anybody. Well, it's true. It was a psyop. And it is honest of him to say that. Of course, I have to explain, you know, why it didn't materialize. And it's true that the media invented this counteroffensive that was supposed to materialize. But the thing that's crazy is that they are not just psyops. I mean, soldiers are being sent to the front in the south. Let's say we'll call it the Nikolaev front. They're being sent there, and they've been being sent there specifically under the pretext, or being, you know, with the rumor mill and the kind of like what the orders are, and what, you know, despite the incompetence and the, you know, issues of language in terms of it isn't like soldiers receive original versions of the first order. So you have to understand the breakdown in the situation in Ukraine. They have national security provisions that prevent soldiers from knowing really what they're doing. So, but that said, they were saying, you know, we saw for the past month, they were saying, we're talking about going back to July, here we are off to the Kherson front, and they're laughing about it, they're getting shelled. But yep, our big counteroffensive, and they're running away. So this has been going on for like quite some time. And why is this, right? Well, one reason is that Russia is preparing the next stage of whatever this is in the former Ukraine. They're actually building up in the south. Although I suspect that, you know, you're going to see simultaneous action. We tried to game out the order of things before, and we've looked at, you know, will it be Nikolaev first? Will it be Kharkiv the city of first, or simultaneous, or one after the other? And, you know, most intelligent commentary on it's probably right. But a very interesting thing happened on the way to the park. We found out from Western media and Western intelligence that Western military analysts and Western journalists are now relying on Russian sources, meaning Telegram, right? Because where else? I mean, from RT, you get very little. I could sit down and give 10 or 15 Russian websites, you know, that get into analysis and all kinds of things. But Rusvesna has a lot of hype, but they have a lot of memoirs, but they have a lot of letters from colonels, retired captains, different levels of brass in the Russian force, often retired. Did I say that? And they'll write these essays and they'll talk about where they think things are going and how this tends to work out. And what you're not getting is similar from Western reportage. Is that the word? Reportage. So they, and I I set up a joke that they need to set up a two-tier system. They need to have a media that they tell people, and then they need a separate media that they get their information from to make sure that what they're telling people isn't accidentally true. They have to know what's true somewhere. I mean, and they're not going to find out what's true from what has now been admittedly the practice of the work of the CIA, which works inside through, you know, at the keyboard, through the physical offices or whatever of the New York Times and Washington Post. It isn't like you have a guy who writes something and then maybe this one's a little bit sensitive and then the editor says, let me call, you know, my guy in the CIA and see if we can run. No. At the level of writing the article, it's CIA. And so how do you get good information? So you actually have reportage about a Ukrainian buildup. It was actually a Russian buildup, and apparently this continues. And then the evidence of the Russian buildup was used to prove that they're preparing to get annihilated by this Ukrainian. What is this? It's like how many lies upon lies, and then you're looking for the, you know, here's the eclipse. You know, that means that the moon god is angry. And the eclipse comes as predicted. You know, the priests know when the eclipse comes. All right, if the gods agree with us, the Russians will be building up their force in the south. Oh, yes, look, they're doing it. They're building up. Oh, that means they're getting ready to lose. Wow, this is the end of the Russian campaign. Look at this massive Russian force buildup. That's a fear-driven buildup, guys. Don't worry. Nothing's going to happen. They're just going to be... It's going to come to a standstill, you know. They're going to... The Ukrainian force and the Russian force, they're going to just zero each other out. No. There is no Ukrainian force. What you have right now is a luxury. Russia is not having to trade very much for anything. They don't need to trade time for lives or trade ammunition for anything. There's nothing that they, everything is a political process and timing. I wouldn't suggest that the Russians are timing the events to line up with the American election. That would be maybe what Americans think. you know, since the world revolves around us, but certainly hasn't escaped anyone's thinking that these events might, you know what I mean, interact with each other. How is this election in the U.S.? People are, you know, this is an election where the outcome is going to be, regardless of the facts of the outcome, this is where we're at right now, regardless of who wins, who's up, who's down, there's no way that the MAGA movement isn't coming away entirely forward and aggressive, entirely unbending. This is going to be a huge catalyst, this election period, whatever the outcome is, whatever the outcome is, that's the thing. Whatever the elites, whatever they're doing on the game, you know, side of the politics and how they're messing with the American people and with these election games and trying to take the culture in a very different direction from where most people are at, right? It's a top-down social transformation and using culture war, which irritates people and divide people even on culture war issues, so that the larger economic stuff is forgotten about. And that's very different today. I mean, the fact that that typical formula isn't working as it should, as it used to, you know, is disconcerting for the elites, because they're finding that people can focus on more than one thing, that one thing is not a distraction from something else. You can be aware of, be informed on what's happening in the conflict in Ukraine. You can know what's happening with the jab, with you know, this whole thing, this whole COVID event, whatever, 201 live drill's gone live. What did Pompeo say? This is a live drill. You find these little glimmers of truth. It's very important, the language, you know, what's happening. The communications are very important to follow. Because one thing you need to understand about many of these elites is that public statements is often the primary way to communicate to others. It should be known what you mean by what you say, and then you might include certain key words, and that's going to be evidence of your position on something. But even though very many things happen behind closed doors, and you have people like Hillary Clinton who says, well, we have, you know, I have a public policy and a private policy. Many people are constantly surveilled, and this goes on with elites, this goes on with, and the best communications to make are just public ones, that you're speaking coded directly to the public. That's how you get the message out there. We talked about revolutionary situations in the past. We talked about how movements, counter-hegemonic movements, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, you know, the methods of Khotob, you know, making the little reel-to-reels, distributing those messages. You had Lenin and the Bolsheviks with the gramophone. They would send around the cylinder scroll things, the cylinders for the gramophones. Kind of like round robin. You have, and there was coded, you know, it's Lenin giving speeches, but in the speeches, you know, based on whatever time mark or on, you know, what he's saying are actually intelligence matters within the Bolshevik Party. This is because they write letters, and they're going to be seized by the Tsarist police. You see how that works? So in the Iranian Revolution, you had the Khomeini. You know, he's in exile, but within Iran, you had people circulating these tapes, okay? Now, was Khotab connected to Western intelligence? You know, was there Soviet intelligence behind the state that involved with the state that would have been in the time of pan-Arabism in Egypt, right, in the 50s? And they had the Union State with Syria briefly. They were technically non-aligned, but you had the Soviets were supportive generally of these moves. They had communist parties, but then they were also supportive of the pan-Arab socialists and the Baathism. Very similar to Nasserism. Michel Aflaq. This is anyway. So the things that are very interesting to me then are the undoing of the political process in the United States, how this lines up with the election. You have a very interesting thing because, and I hate to say this, but it's almost like from the perspective of writing, like a series, it's almost like there's kind of a lull in this Russia part of the story of this great drama. And we've come into, you know, we're trying to approach the, I don't know, like the mid-season finale or something. Oh no, this would be before the winter. So we're approaching the season finale. And then we go into this kind of a flashback narrative story. I kind of want to get to the storming of Nikolaev or Kharkiv part. You see what I'm saying? And instead, I'm over here looking at, you know, going back into my notes about the FBI raiding Trump allies in the past and how I said it would be a very bad sign. This was around the time of the last election a couple years ago. I said it would be a very bad sign after, you know, the November outcome if the FBI raided him. It would be a very bad sign in terms of the agreement that was made or the balance of things where they're at. Because I know that one of the things that you have to remember about a president who actually uses the authorities of the president that have been crept into this, a little bit of an executive top heavy theory of executive power to an extent. Actually, I agree with the former attorney general under the Trump administration on this question of the that the executive branch is different from other branches in that the executive of the executive branch is also the executive of all of the functions and departments, cabinets, and things that are under the executive branch. So they're not decentralized. And in response to that, Pelosi doesn't take a contrary view to that view of the president. She just continues to maintain that each branch is co-equal. So then, therefore, then the Speaker of the House has the executive powers of the of that branch. And that's a different question about constitutional theory. In other words, should the top position of the legislative branch be the most legislative-y, or should it be the most executive-y? Should the top, you know, position in the judicial branch, should it be the most executive-y, or should it be the most judicially? You see what I'm saying? And there's a thinking that the top of the executive branch is the most executive, and the top of the legislative branch is the most deferential to the legislature, and the top of the judicial, that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court acts as a judge between the judges, not as a an executive and not as a legislator. So that's different theories about application of separation of powers and the leadership positions within those branches of government. But that's part of this whole crisis in the U.S. right now. Just to understand, there's never been a Speaker of the House before that had an official sign, like printed by the office of the Capitol building that says, introducing Madam Speaker or something, like in gold letters, like on a purple. It's very fucking weird, right? Introducing Madam, or, you know, whatever. Kamala Harris, that's Mrs. President of the Senate to you. It's like, okay, dude. Yeah, so we have the President of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and all of them have an opinion on what the FBI under the Justice Department can or can't do. And the fact that you didn't have the elimination of the CIA or the elimination of the FBI under the Trump administration in the way that, let's say, Kennedy might have proposed doing, may have been part of Trump avoided getting killed. And I don't think that people appreciate the level of the swamp and the level of corruption, and people kind of vacillate in their treatment of Trump. It's inconsistent, and I would say, and it's not my job to be fair to anybody, but to be fair to you and to be fair to ourselves, I mean, it's not my job to be fair to Trump, but to be fair to ourselves, we would say that that these attacks either accuse him of being part of the system or they accuse him of not using the powers that he had against the system. And I've noticed that people will actually say the same thing, that, you know, one is proof of the other. And so, and even though that explanation does adequately describe all of the functions that we see, it's adding an additional inelegant, you know, it's adding an inelegant addition to this to suggest that you have all these other layers, you know, that actually Trump isn't, that this and that, and, you know, you can say that, but you've added things that are inelegant to your explanation. That's all. That's all we mean to say. And this is happening, and many people who are following correctly the story inside of Ukraine and Russia and kind of getting good information are the same people in the U.S. who are, on the one hand, not surprised, but also completely outraged with what the FBI has done to the president. People say, don't you mean the former president? Well, in the U.S., we just refer to him as the president, and I just have a funny habit of referring to the guy who won the election as, you know, the president. It's just a weird habit I have, but, you know, I'll get over it, I'm sure. But it is a very, very bizarre thing. And what's interesting is that the same New York Times and Washington Post wrote hit pieces against AMLO, the Mexican president, López Obrador, because he's proposing to go after four ex-presidents. He's in pursuit of criminally prosecuting four past presidents. And AMLO is like the Trump of Russia. Sorry, of Mexico. Putin is the Trump of Russia, right? AMLO is the Trump of Mexico. And my wife walked in here and grabbed a wallet, and which is a very, you know, off my desk, which is a very common practice here in Casa Flores. And I like started saying, Russia, 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 Mexico. We had some like cakes delivered, to the preschool, and we had to like pay the caterer cupcakes, you know, birthday. my daughter's two. Happy birthday, my little two-year-old, my clone. So bizarre. There's no doubt who the father is. Let me tell you, nature works in funny ways. It's been very therapeutic. When you see an infant with your same face that you had as an infant, as a two-year-old, whatever, and their laughter and their, and you can you kind of relive this through them, and you're like, wow, you remember these things, and you start remembering events in your life and kind of get back to basic on the things that were probably more formative than we acknowledge. A lot of us think about formative in our maybe early teens or having a mentor or something, but this stuff goes back to, you know, kids 2, 3, 4 years old. It's so critical. But yeah, so you have with AMLO, sorry, a little detour. With AMLO, he's actually trying to drain the swamp. And he is breaking out of this stupid history of Mexico's recent past, meaning the last 100 years, of this fake, of this stupid game between the PRI and attempts to either get back in line with the vision of the Mexican Revolution or go forward in the direction of neoliberal Washington consensus reforms, right? And then you have AMLO with a third way. And he proposes his ideological thing is called the fourth transformation. And this is a very powerful, I should say, a sweeping visionary. This is a, you know, an ideologist's wet dream whenever you have a contemporary politician, because it harkens back to the times when people actually had beliefs. Not a collection of policy positions that are fine-tuned to every election to squeeze out 3 or 4 more percent of, like, fuck you, you know, when people believed in things. And the thing was, like, the whole package. It's not just like a, you know, a checkerboard or a puerile pastiche of various positions of the day. Like, I was against choice until I was for it. I was in favor of it until I was against it. I proposed it until I rescinded it. I lived in it until I moved out. I sold it to you until I took it back. It's like, okay. So you can see that in times of crisis, when you have this time of peace, of course the elites are always at war with each other. And of course, to the deplorables, to we the people, les misérables, the proletariat, the plebeians, we see them as a united front. And we see the things that they do in collective action against us. They see all of our divisions in ways that the differences between us can be manipulated. And they have also employed a whole network of thousands and thousands of people, tens of thousands of people working out of prisons, working out of India, who are a troll army whose job it is to spin black pill yarns, to build self-defeating narratives, to make you believe that you've been defeated before you've even gone to fight. The best way to win is to convince the other side they've already lost. And so much of that propaganda is what you get from the negativistic realm. It's very deceiving. Uh-huh. Pedro, I don't know if you hear me, but you put on a you've said you want to speak, so I'm gonna. I guess you have a question. Was there not a question? All good then. Yeah, it's hard for me to get the, you know, the mic or whatever, the speaker on this thing to actually work, because it my mic seems to hijack the thing. I can do it from the phone pretty well, but just be careful, because if I don't recognize you, I just think you made an error. But if you listen to the show regularly and you put up your hand to ask a question, I'm going to think that you're, you know, actually trying to speak. Anyway, so in this time of crisis, you're gonna get tend to find that countries that want, every country has a permanent administration, has a deep state, okay, and many of those, and that's sort of like the informal continuation of government concepts and values that need to transcend the outcomes of parliamentary elections, right? Which may take a country in a very radically negative course just by the result of some fanaticism or wave hysteria that swept across the population and their voting. This is the argument, by the way, against democracy and for rigged elections. But you can see, you have to look at this from all the different angles, because many people who bemoan any sort of degradation of the democratic process when their position is on the rise, but then if it looks like the masses have been taken over by some crazy whatever fad in thinking, Pizzagate or something, then you have to take away these elections. That's how this cabal thinks. But every country has a permanent administration, but a permanent administration is simply the consequence of a Republican system, of a constitutional system, because you have this idea of a, typically speaking, a bicameral legislature. And the institutional interests and the long-term interests, of course, are going to be invested interests. And, of course, they're going to be connected to landed and property interests, because this is reality. And this is something called society. And so the Senate is going to tend to represent those more, you know, even at the risk of being ossified, interests in a society. But that's actually part of the glue, right? That's actually part of the glue in a society. And it's very hard to deconstruct that without making everything spin out sideways. Does that make sense? So when AMLO proposed to prosecute four past presidents who, listen, should be prosecuted, I'm going to say should be prosecuted. AMLO's absolutely right. I mean, you're just going to have, Mexico has no future if it's going to continue to be little more than a neo-colony and a maquiladora system of cheap labor for goods that the U.S. anyway, for its own interest, should be producing itself, for its own workers, for its own internal economy, should be producing itself. This crack pipe dream of now we are a service economy, only possible through the lens of absolute spectral disorder. We're talking about, you know, Asperger's plus, where you think that the where you do what's called reification. You confuse the socially constructed boundaries that are used in one area of, you know, categorizing things, and then you actually think that those are parts of a physical reality that then are the factors relating to other things. What do I mean by this? Well, concretely, you have people who believe that the ideas of things in the abstract are what determine their prudence in a given instantiation. And you have people whose job it is, and they've been hired through these institutions with tunnel vision, and they actually discourage interdisciplinarity. They're trying to produce over people who are overly specialized, and fachidiots. It's fachidiotismus, the phenomenon of fachidiotismus, German, a fachidiot is a person who is basically a moron, but they're highly, trained, educated is even a complimentary word in this case. They're trained in a specific area, and they're trained for many years, and this gives them maybe like a piece of paper, certificate, degree or something, and then they go on thinking that based upon the things they've learned from that little tiny slice of life are sufficient to understand the whole pie. And that's the difference between specialists and generalists. We're missing generalists in our society. We always meet these specialists, and it's like, okay, but where's the generalist who can put these things together and can actually help you figure out which specialists are suffering from, their spectral disorders taking them off the range of usability, right? Russia's permanent representative to the UN, Nebenzia, he has been talking about this nuclear catastrophe at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. And this is happening, of course, at the same time that Trump's being raided. I don't know what they... Look, there's a lot of stuff happening inside of internal MAGA world, and there's many, many other cases and many other people and many other things. There's going to be, people on drugs, mentally retarded people, Timothy Holmstead, people like this, mental illness. It's good that it's hard to put people into... insane asylums. I think it's actually very good that it's hard to do that. But this is just, I'm totally in favor of Timothy Pentagon Pedophile Task Force Holmstead doing what he does. That's a sign, if he can do that, then, let us all be free. You know what I mean? But there's going to be people who think that the raid was about deep underground military bases with children and stuff. There's going to be people who think that that's what it's about. There's going to be people who think that this is about biological weapons in Ukraine and all this stuff. Broadly speaking, it's about all of those things, but you're just looking at a permanent administration in the U.S. that's gone into the direction of a breakaway culture. And many of the things that were established as provisions against the worst possibilities. Why would you have a permanent administration? We explain. So that permanent administration is supposed to safeguard against radical turns in the society. It's sort of an informal but very real outgrowth of a bicameral legislature. Or rather, a bicameral legislature is a reflection of a society, of a class system. And one of the downsides of having a wage labor-based capitalist system it's not the capitalism issue of it, it's in terms of the distribution of salaries that people are wage earners instead of part owners, instead of all salaries being effectively, in the most immediate sense and in a scalable way and in a fluctuating way, the value of the company, right? And then you've tied people to the interest and they're invested in, right? So there's many ways that that can work. But what we've done is do salary and you're a non-owner. So people might just vote, okay, against their employer for reasons relating to their working conditions or their rights at the job, but the outcome of those elections could result in a period of civil war, could result in a very serious change in the distribution of wealth in the society. That might be a good thing, but then you might have changes in decision-making processes that are influenced by maybe the ideological side of whatever junta is, you know, redistributing wealth away from the wealth appropriators. So, you know, you get a lot of potential outcomes that are hard to, you know, predict. So permanent administration obviously is part of the society itself, the deep state. But so therefore, if you wanted to subvert a society, because you have a deep state whose aim is to keep that from being subverted through the mechanisms, the accessible levers and mechanisms of power, such as share ownership, such as, you know, we're talking about, you know, shareholder democracy, such as parliamentary elections, like the American system of elections, all part of it. But those can go unpredictable, let's say, especially if you lose control of media. What if media goes totally horizontal and loses these verticals of power and so-called responsibility? These are all the reasons that we explain why it was, from the point of view of the permanent administration, it was important to subvert and to change the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. Because from their point of view, the changes, but you know, are bad for the society. In other words, that's the thinking of many of the operators who think that they're informed about how those things work. And let me tell you, that indoctrination even occurs in the military. In the military, they're training non-commissioned officers coming up through the ranks that in these officer schools, that the American system works because of its permanent administration. That, in other words, the deep state is what makes it work. And it's true in terms of every society. The term deep state we get from the Turkish deep state, you know. And it's very interesting because Turkey's deep state is such a subject for debate. I'm of the view that the deep states of countries like Turkey and Brazil and Mexico and a few others, that there have been critical coups against foreign interests or against the embedded interests of the Washington consensus and the American deep state in those intelligence services. So there have been pushes to remove the American deep state even from Germany. Merkel was on about this. They were trying to clean up the German. The main focus of the cleanup of the German intelligence services was they're being spied upon by the Americans. Okay, that should tell you about where people really are at with these big grand alliances and what the so-called Western alliance or what NATO it really is all about, if that's what's really happening. Countries are trying to shore up their security against each other within the alliance. Look at Turkey removing the American deep state from its own deep state. Look at how the Americans tried to activate the Gulen group and tried to stage a coup just recently. I mean, in the scheme of things, what was it, 6 years ago or something? So you have never had a crisis political crisis at this level in the United States. What has precipitated this political crisis is a quote unquote economic crisis, but really you're talking about the revenue streams of the Western Empire. It's really the American Empire that lived in two different worlds for quite some time, but after the destruction of the Soviet Union, the most honest group to talk about the real existing problems of how the U.S. will not be able to monopolize that moment, how the U.S. was going to be suffering from Hannibal's curse. That's not Hannibal Lecter. That's Hannibal Barca. That's the Carthaginian leader against the Romans. He was excellent at making victories, but was not able to build momentum and capitalize on those to make those each victory into a springboard to the next victory. Okay. Any victories that Scipio had against Hannibal would have been probably a outcome of this. And ultimately, Carthage failed. Gordon, Mr. Halev, did you have something to say? I'm going to try. I really want to try to see that this can work. I think it can. Let me see if I hear you. And I hope it's not an error to try to do this. Gordon, can you speak? It says you can speak. Yes, you're live. All right, never mind. So yeah, be careful with your fingers, because this we are doing call in, so if you're saying you're calling in, it's, you know, it can make it tricky for me. Now you have the United States is not going to be able to mobilize the military. No one's going to die. Like, people in the military are in the military in the same way that they work for McDonald's. Most of the jobs are McDonald's type jobs, supply line. Like, when you not McDonald's at the place, although there's cafeteria jobs in the military, many cafeteria jobs in the military. The logistics for McDonald's, like the trucks and the you know, regional managers and how the whole thing works out, the U.S. military and McDonald's are like the same thing. And the corporate culture is very similar. And everyone, their professionalism and just doing my job and stuff like that. And I say professionalism not in the positive sense, like professionalism in the absence of, I don't know, patriotism or belief. This is not a belief-driven military. And the thing is that in civilizational conflicts where the outcomes are high stakes, the types of fights that you would fight in, our army's not set up for that. There's no thing to fight for. You see, Americans are trying to escape the present situation that their government has imposed on them. They're not going to fight for that government in some offensive operation elsewhere in the world, period. And you're gonna have your McDonald's, Walmart employees, and some of them are handed guns and they go do these things, and they might send 2,000 or 3,000 people here or there, somewhere in Africa, or, you know. And all of it is, so much of it is like money laundering scams, but with these different deployments, but then also it's for foreign consumption. And but internally, people don't believe that there's any real American interest being advanced. You know, I remember talking to a guy, we're talking about Yugoslavia, and he's like, yes, but, you know, your country was doing the best thing in the interest of your people, and so I don't blame your country, America, for what you did to Yugoslavia. I said, the thing is that there was no fucking trickle-down economics out of this empire stuff that the U.S. has been building, by the way. That's where these goddamn Maoists get everything backwards. They can't establish this mimkonomics, you know, that the standards of living are improved as a consequence of the colonial system of supply lines and foreign production. You can't establish that fact. And you have to be living at the time, you have to be living in a delusion bubble about what your standard of living really was, or you'd have to be like most Maoists out of Mim, from like Berkeley or something, or Oakland. Totally disconnected. I don't mean Oakland ghetto. I mean Oakland in the bus to Berkeley, the train or whatever. It's a totally unreality that these people are living in. And consequently, many of these beliefs among people in the so-called Axis of Resistance countries, or many people around the world, actually think that Americans have a high standard of living when they don't, number one. But whatever standard they do have, they think it comes from foreign interventionism or the empire, and it doesn't. It doesn't. America is a big country. It's not like England, where you look at how do people on this tiny island live so well until you find out they live so badly, like no teeth, like all these 300 square foot apartments in England, all these people living in poverty. The world is a fucking lie, yo. Like all this stuff about first world country, second, that's a lie. There's rich people, poor people everywhere. There's ghettos, there's posh neighborhoods everywhere. You can live anywhere in the world and you're going to be you're going to be in with what you do. You're going to be able to live at the level that you expect or what you want, pretty much. Standard of living in the UK is much lower than the standard of living in the former Yugoslavia. And we had a war here recently. Like, what's your excuse? You know what I mean? Like, that's real weird. So that's how toxic this empire myth concept is. Like, if you feel like you're on the up or things are improving, like you're a, you know, impoverished, worker, unemployed, the former worker, and you think, well, at least we're in England. It's like, no, dude, it's like, and you're in England, not at least, not but you're in England. That's part of the problem. And same, you know, in the US, a lot of it's just unsustainable. Desert in the West, like without air conditioning as such, it's just uninhabitable. It's like Australia. So there's a lot of negative thinking about what Americans, there's a lot of kind of personal negativity out there in the world and stuff. And it's people, but people who know better know, and people who are not angry aren't trying to find big causes to justify their anger and stuff. They know better than that. But yeah, so back to our main subjects. So all of these events coming together at once, you've had very slow information now. You know, the Russians have changed their reporting. I follow this very carefully. They're no longer calculating the total number of Ukrainians killed. Now they're not doing the same number of reports. Sometimes now they're actually playing down what's happening. And we saw this happen before there was the pushes that we saw with Severodonetsk and Lysychansk, which were actually very big turning points. Everyone agrees. To say that they're not is like to be an Arestovich. You'd have to agree at one point that it was a big deal, like he did, and then after they lose it, then start to talk about how it's not a big deal once you lose it. Lysychansk, Severodonetsk, huge deal. And even though you've had very big things on the artillery end and a lot of political developments, and the whole house of cards is collapsing around Zelensky, you have a lot of dissent, a lot of the turnover, a lot of firings, a lot of this, and none of that looks good. None of those things are signs that they're reorganizing for a better day or anything like this. This is like the rats jumping off the ship, and everybody blaming each other for the consequences. And Russia's been lining its ducks up in a row. And what I think, what we're seeing now, just kind of looking at, again, there's the immediate reporting, and then you can keep up with, you know, let's say people that compile all of the mixed information from open source intelligence and the kind of pro-Russian Telegram, and you can, people like the guy who does Defense Politics Asia does something like this, and then he updates a map. He has a system of putting all of the, what Defense Politics Asia does is he has a system, and I don't know if he programmed it, but all of the events that come up in a ticker, like that talk about an event happened at a location, he just pops that in and it puts that event on the location on the map. So then you can see where all these things are happening in Ukraine. So I look at that. I spend too much time on Ukrainian Telegram. And because it used to be, I come back with so much treasure for you guys, and we had so many fucking memes to make out of it. And it's been slow lately because things are coming undone. And to the extent that Russia can, to the extent that you know that there's going to be a big crisis around the election, and a lot of the things can't be done in the U.S. until you kind of have what they call a mandate, and that doesn't normally happen till after the election. That's November. So a lot of the things that Russia might have to do that are everything's connected to information war, and that do relate to what the U.S. is doing, not because the world revolves around the U.S., but because Ukrainian leadership revolves around the U.S. And because Ukrainian leadership revolves around the U.S., the relationship to what the U.S. can do after the election is going to be different. And what they want to do after the election in response to Russia is going to be framed and delimited by what Russia is able to do just before that election. So you're looking at September, October, as very big months for operations that must take Mykolaiv and Odessa and Kharkov. I even think Sumy, to be honest with you, and a couple others even off the table. But certainly you need the city of Kharkiv, and you need the city of Odessa, and you need the city of Mykolaiv irretractably contested or Russian as this goes forward. And you want to look at, for example, how badly the politics of war at election works out for the cabal, for the American deep state. You had in the 2016 American presidential election, they wanted to make foreign policy be largely a focus around, what about Aleppo? Remember Gary Johnson? What's Aleppo? Aleppo. So in the Syrian crisis, the outcome of Aleppo and the siege of Aleppo captivated and was a big part of, you know, fascinating. It probably eliminated the libertarian from the race such that they could never build up a libertarian base against Trump. You know, the guy was totally stoned. I think he smoked a joint. And then he gets on TV and they ask him, what would you do about Aleppo? And he says, what's Aleppo? It's like, what's Alpo? It's like, the dog food? What are you talking about, man? Like, I have the munchies like a motherfucker, but I don't eat dog food when I'm high, if that's the insinuation, yo. Poor guy. He's like, what is Aleppo? But that's what's going to be like if you have Odessa or you have and or Mikhailiev and or Kharkov, and you have AOC after the election are trying to tell whatever, you have a gang of four, and then AOC is going to be asked, what about Mikhailiev? And she's going to say, we stand with Ms. Mikhailiev, and we're sure that all the allegations are true. Unbelievable. And, I'm sorry. It's just too much. The Trump fiasco, the FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago, when it happened, I said at the moment, I said, it's almost like Trump couldn't have asked for anything better in terms of marketing, you know, the outcome. And of course, that fuels conspiracy theories about Trump's relationship to media or Trump, you know, whatever. But, I don't rule out that there's enough of a group inside the permanent establishment, the permanent administration that wants Trump. Trump couldn't have happened. Obviously, a split in the elites means that you have a split in their system. It's not like there's these new elites that are not part of the system. Saying that this or that politician has too many ties to the cabal or to the deep state is a retarded man's way of understanding politics. I mean, it's fine, but there are differences among we men. Some of us are dumber than others. That's a fact, unfortunately. There's always somebody younger, taller, better looking, wealthier. Okay. Always somebody. And, if we think that being photographed next to somebody or having been involved with somebody in business means that we're part of their goals, it's because we ourselves have not been involved in things even resembling those things of that level. And that's fine. I mean, we should be humble people if we're humble people, but when we project our, middle-class sensibilities onto the decision processes or the, elbow rubbing of the elites, then we've missed it. We don't know what's going on. We have the wrong story. But this is very bad polling for Democrats. So just by the numbers, because we're trying to look to see at what's going to happen in the U.S. now, obviously very banana republic type stuff, right? Now, there was a poll done, actually, the Trafalgar group does polling, and you know about them, and they did one with the Convention of States poll, and it shows that the majority of independents, about 54%, okay, this is independents. Okay, 54% of independents believe that Trump's political enemies are behind the FBI raid. Okay, they're joined by 77% of Republicans who hold the same view. Remember that somewhere close to 80% of people who voted for Trump in the last election, which may have been close to twice the number of people who voted for Biden in reality. We'll never know, or we won't know. We do know. We do know. We don't know if it'll be acknowledged. So that 77% is a very large number. It's not 2/3 or, 3/4 of voters, rather. It's not 3/4 of voters, right? Because you have Democrats. But it's much more than, it's not like 40% of voters, just because it's three-fourths of Democrats are not half the voters. That's the crazy thing. So when you look at these numbers, think you're actually looking at probably more like 60% in these federal national elections. 70% are voting however Trump says to vote. So now these two groups, independents and Trump Republicans, okay, they are enthusiastic. They're going to vote. They're going to turn out the vote based on this FBI raid. And for people who were thinking, because there had been subterfuge within MAGA and the post-election fallout, and then there had been a lot of people, I voted for Trump, but now I think he's part of them. I think he's part of the system. Well, now they Roger Stoned his ass. You know, Roger Stone was part of the system too, okay? Roger Stone was part of the system, and Roger Stone's connections to people in Ukraine, well, he was connected to the people in Ukraine that wanted Ukraine to be a normal country, a neutral country, to have pro-European and pro-Russian trade policies, never join NATO, and, you know, if in 10 or 20 years we join the EU, that's great. But we're not going to, like, we're not rushing, and it's all good. That was the last government. That was Yanukovych. And Roger Stone and all of Trump's connections into Ukraine/Russia were ultimately co-aligned or lined up exactly with structures that favor Russia's position in Ukraine. So Trump, Roger Stone, and then their, you know, evil Russian oligarch connection, which became Blue Anon talking points, which infiltrated into the pro-Trump conspiracy milieu with these Blue Anon talking points, like, you know, pointing out the things that are the obvious parts of the story and then making those the problem. Like, well, you know, Trump himself was a billionaire. Oh, no fucking shit. Wow, really? And do you know that he met the Clintons before? Oh, yeah, wow. Stuff like this, but with the people below him. It's like, oh, did you know that General Flynn is aware there's a country called Israel and that he went there? Wow. Are you aware that Flynn or this person or that person? It's like, yes, these are insiders. So evidence that they are insiders as evidence that there's not a problem in and between the insiders. This is not the same fucking thing, people. Three quarters of Democrats think that the raid was impartial justice. They just thought it was just the workings of the justice system. They assume that Trump did something illegal because that's what they hear on the news and without any evidence. But the thing is that if you're talking about what the Democrats think is supposed to turn out, get out the vote, they're not enthusiastic about Trump. They're not going to be like, oh, I love Pelosi's Democrats now. Let's get behind the Pelosi agenda. Like, yo, rank and file Democrats hate Nancy Pelosi. They're mad at Bernie Sanders for being weak. They hate Nancy Pelosi. They totally get that the Green New Deal is fake. Some of them are under the, we're talking about the the activists of the Democrat Party that are on the periphery, not the activists in the Clinton DNC line. What you're talking about are the activists that come out of the university Democrats, which always competing with campus communists and campus socialists for legitimacy. And then among those, you have who come out of the universities who then go into, if they're particularly left, and they know what that is in the old sense of the term, they get involved in these labor unions. And then the labor unions is a subject for another show, but it's a huge crisis in the U.S. The point is that Democrats are not going to be mobilized by the raid. Republicans are totally mobilized, and people, it's going to be very hard. I'm not saying you can't utter the fucking words. It's going to be very hard to convince people that Trump is part of the system in the meaningful sense that people, that, you know, negs will say it. After this Roger Stoning that he has suffered, he was Roger Stoned. And everybody knows it. And the I'm not here to bemoan the fabric of our society, and now people don't have faith in the system. Like, that's long gone, yo. Like, this is a old story. Please, let's not talk like this is a new thing. Like, now we know the system is corrupt, and this isn't part of the plan. Like, in the sense that now you see how bad the FBI is. Like, yo, we've known these fucking homosexual Mormons, whatever the fuck is going on with this cult called the FBI. Look, don't get me wrong. I love homosexuals. I love Mormons. But something about putting the two together in the FBI creates some mad fuck that we have right now. I'm just saying, as a fact. As a fact of this case, you know, admitted by this judge right here. Okay. Let me look at some of your comments, if you have any. Good. I didn't leave a section, so I don't have them. Look what I did. Wonderful. I just got love for Julio Iglesias. Thank you. But yeah, let's put our points together. I'm expecting that the news that Russia played the information war on the nuclear power plant. Of course, any, you know, number of things could have happened on the ground. We don't really know. We always have to look at cui bono. Our understanding of cui bono is very narrative driven, or what facts we remember, what facts we think are in play. My take is, putting it all together how I have it, Russia does not have an interest in sabotaging this nuclear power plant that they control. And they also, I think that Russia is going to handle this differently than we saw with the other power plant. And I think that the symbolism around that and what Russia did with that, I think it was, you know, very hard, very bad optics. But when you look at, and I'm just saying, what they floated, you can't take away from me the bad optics of the withdrawal or whatever. And I read the paper that was being shared from the Marine Corps military science, talking about that Russia was doing a war of maneuver. I mean, I said that when it happened. I said right when it happened that this was not a withdrawal in the sense of a retreat, you know, or a retreat in the sense of a loss. Actually, both the words withdrawal and retreat should be considered quite neutral. We always think that they mean bad things when they happen. When you're watching two boxers box, you know, and a boxer steps back before he punches, you don't say, oh, now he's cowering from the fight. Oh, now he's winding up to punch. No, you say, oh, he's winding up to punch. But in language, we talk about retreat. We think that's bad. in personal life, we say, hey, no surrender, no retreat. We understand that. And we think we're being militaristic. We're actually being dumb, because in military thinking, a retreat and a withdrawal themselves two different things, but neither one of them has necessarily a negative connotation to it. In fact, it may be part of your plan to draw in the opponent by doing a retreat, okay? Especially if they misread that retreat as some, you know, that you feel weak, that you know, that you're responding to a sense of weakness and you're repositioning to strengthen your position. You see? So, how now you will find Russia's approach is going to be different now. And I don't think that they move, I don't think that they get away from this. I don't think they do like what they did before with Chernobyl. I saw them do a very big show around Chernobyl and showing, they did some agitational propaganda showing the Ukrainian and Russian military guys at the Chernobyl plant working together. They kept the Ukrainian guys in the Ukrainian uniform, and they kept the Russian guys in the Russian uniforms. And they told a story about this is how everything can work together. And it was a really cool story. And then it just went away. It went away, and whatever the agreement was, and Turkey, I imagine that all these things are connected. Turkey, grain, the getting through the strait, Turkey controls there. Marmara. So good luck, you know, good luck, because now all these things are going to have to come together at once. Fascinating, fascinating. And now with the way that this is shaping up, you're going to have, I expect, once these, that the condition, like reading a lot of reports and you get mixed stuff, but the condition, a lot of these entrenched positions that the Russians are continuing to attrit, okay, that the condition of these are already such that they could now blitzkrieg through and pick up, you know, hundreds of kilometers of territory within a matter of a few days or a week, once they decide to do that. And the only real, I mean, there's all these different factors happening at once. So like I said, this is a political, these are political decisions about when Russia kind of does this. And, but in those political decisions, of course, are questions of acceptable losses. You might go for another month like this and reduce your, you know, increase that ratio, reduce your losses in your cleanup, in your occupation and cleanup operations. Maybe you push that to, you know, 40 to 1 or something, 50 to 1. I don't know. So you just, but there's really nothing holding it back now. And you have a lot of political concerns, and you have these crises and these kind of attempts at almost like false flag type stuff that are supposed to throw up sand or whatever in the air and kind of slow down the momentum of these operations politically. You see? So it's political again. And the political and the information war are tightly connected. So it's important to get a, you know. Now, the British Ministry of Defense had sent instructors to Ukraine and were the ones that were directing the shelling of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Okay. And how the British did this is similar to how the Russians did this in 2014 when they got some of their special forces guys into the Donbass to be Donbass special forces. They were given leave, or they're officially listed even as AWOL. That's actually happening now with the British. They have specialist instructors. They have people fighting at different levels, some mercenaries, some as a private officer contractor. It's a little bit more, the level of government involvement in brokering those relationships is very different than with mercenaries who may even officially be discouraged or may even be illegal from their country despite being a NATO country or whatever. This is at a more official level, but it works very similarly. It's just with higher level, like brass. And these are the people who were involved, the British instructors. They aimed the artillery at the nuclear power plant. That's what seems to be coming out from the story. And the UN also stopped short of saying who had done the shelling, lamenting the outcome, you know, mentioning the conflict, mentioning Russia's involvement, and mentioning how lamentable this thing is. And you would almost think that Russia had done it, except, you know, what he couldn't say is who had done it. So he doesn't say that Russia has done it either, because that would also be insane. I mean, which is not beneath them or whatever. But in this case, they were not totally insane, just a little crazy. Just kind of, you know, it's a bad thing that happened. We don't know, well, you know, who did it, but very bad. Very, very bad. Now, how are we going to deal with the fact that right now with Ukraine, basically, and I'll tell you why we know other things. I follow a lot of the gore, because new gore videos, new ones, are dependent upon Russia advancing into areas that they had formerly attrited. That's where you're getting seeing these bodies. So seeing those bodies, and when they're taken by Russians, that's evidence that Russia is advancing into the areas that they have previously attrited. I have seen a slowdown of those in general, and I don't think because there's some effective way to manage suppressing these videos. I think that there are less of these videos being made right now because the Russians in large numbers are not moving into positions that they could be taking. And I look at that in terms of, you know, a lot of the conflict in 2014 and with the Minsk agreement, like at that time when the Minsk agreement was made, Russia was in the position to push forward militarily. And they always do the opposite of what you would think somebody would do. I mean, intuitively, if you didn't have a background in understanding this, you would think that every time that you had been defeated or every time that you were in a weak position, that you would call for whatever. You would call for let's go to the negotiating table. Let's have it. There's a lot of informal agreements going on, and a lot of things are coded for other things. Like, for example, the agreement around Odessa and grain was actually code for other things, like Russia will use the Navy to reinforce an attack, but the invasion is not going to be a naval one, but ultimately Odessa is going to be Russian. And how Turkey agrees with how we manage the getting formerly Ukrainian wheat to global markets and stuff like that, this is all the normalization of it. See, they skip to the normalization. They don't talk about, you would never have heard this grain agreement with Turkey and Russia be the agreement on the divisions of the profits of expropriated Ukrainian grain. You would never heard the deal talked about that way, but that's what it fucking was, right? So let's talk about what that means more broadly. Is this is Turkey plugging itself into the post-Ukraine economy, which is basically Odessa and Mykolaiv are, if Turkey wants to do big deals about the things that happen there, who do they talk to make those deals? They talk to Russia. So that is what has been established. So in a very informal but very tangible and much more real than a piece of paper kind of way, Turkey has already acknowledged Russia's sovereignty in Odessa and Mykolaiv. These are the things that have to move in place politically, and I'm kind of trying to track maybe where the U.S. election fits into that, and then also look at the, you know, false flags and terrorist things with this Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, things like this that either change our focus, divert the political momentum, and in so doing, try to attempt to affect the clock. Or even the order of operations. So the chronology of operations by time and the order of operations order of operations. And altogether, this paints a picture to me that Russia is continuing to attempt, and this is just, and I know some people are just frustrated at this, and it's continued to frustrate people, I understand, but, you know, the world doesn't revolve around our frustrations, okay? Russia's continuing to attempt to show their desire or ability or generosity. It's almost a flex, because it's saying, now's your time to get in on this deal. We still invite you, like, you know, the contestants are still welcome to play, like, come, you know, back, the price is right, like, they're still inviting everyone to come. Let's look at the reality of the situation. This is the reality of the situation on the ground. This is what military science says. This is what the, you know, economics basically says. This is, your experts agree on the outcome, our experts agree on the outcome. You know, the U.S. is doing something else. That's fine. But all these other countries can get involved in different ways. Hey, yo, Romania, would you want a piece of this land? Well, maybe that's part of the deal, too. Medvedev certainly didn't not share that picture of a map that shows a former Ukraine with Romania and Poland controlling parts of the west of that failed state. Those things don't float there for no reason. We've talked about Poland going into Ukraine and the transatlantic effort to merge Poland and Ukraine. And, you know, they had this idea already from before, but it was supposed to succeed. You know, it's called Intermarium. It's basically like the Visegrad group countries, you know, plus or minus a few, but it's this idea of Middle Europa or the Baltic to Black Sea corridor or power base. It's basically New Europe, in the words of the former Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld, and the and U.S. policy now, like we see that the old kind of Committee on the Present Danger people were kind of overpassed by the neocons, who had very similar and co-aligned things with the Committee on the Present Danger people, but also very different. And I mean, the Committee on the Present Danger, in their moves against the trilateralists, obviously the neocons were a welcome ally to the committee people, the Present Danger. But ultimately, you could see that the neoconservatives can flip back into the narrative idealism of the trilateralism without three sides anymore. Now it's basically just the transatlanticists, the two sides, not Japan anymore. So trilateralism is done, but the Present Danger stuff is also kind of done too. I mean, the ban and resurrection of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, is a very interesting thing, and I talked about it several years ago, but that's part of this inter-elite conflict, the approach to China. The real balancing act in the end is that China is balanced by Eurasia. The idea of China integrating into Eurasia, and that Eurasian integration, even if it involves Russia, but if it's led by China or probably involves China, then it's unacceptable to the Western powers. But even among the rational of the Western powers, even among those who recognize that multipolarity is growing, they don't want to just have a new monopolarity of some Berlin, Moscow, Beijing axis, right? That's not multipolarity. That's just a new, global hegemonic superstate with global hegemonic aspirations. So it's sensible. It's not realistic to divide Russia from China if you're pursuing transatlanticism. Does that make sense? So there's a lot of mismatches and stuff. And be that as it may, and as ugly as it looked to some people, the thinking, I'm not talking about outcomes, that's a different discussion, but the thinking and the theory behind the international relations approach to the Trump administration is closest to like a reasonable outcome of multipolarity. Don't focus on their China rhetoric. That's not to lead to a war with China, by the way. That's not at all the thinking. But for Russia, it's about allowing these kind of human processes that go in these directions to go in those directions, unfettered by the old geopolitical machinations, the old geopolitical map of the world. It actually makes sense for Europe and Russia to integrate economically and have a common security thing, and to have and to treat China with respect and to do the right things with China and not escalate tensions, but to understand that Eurasia is not East Asia. And I'm not talking about what I think, by the way. I'm talking about what is acceptable to the
American white hats. I'm not including Bannon in that, by the way. I don't know. I just he's on a different level of grift. People really need to separate, you know. I totally get the cursus honorum and everything like that, but it's totally disastrous to look forward to wars just because you think that your kids are going to be able to promote up some cursus honorum. Like, you don't want to be like an evil senator or something like that. Steve Bannon sees himself like he's a senator, but has never been elected to anything in his life. I'm just giving you a heads up. If you fall asleep next to Steve Bannon, you'll wake up with some infection in your asshole for sure. So I'm just saying, you know, how politics works in reality. But this fight, this is why you have, you know, Victoria Nuland, whose husband Kagan, so these are original neocons, right, of the Obama administration. Whereas, you know, Obama, the Obama hype, and the fact that he's not Bush, the reason that the Europeans loved Obama was because Obama was going to, his change to the Bush formula was to improve the part of the game that Europe got out of the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. So Obama was involved in promising or proposing or whatever a better deal for Europe out of the U.S. Occupation war or whatever in Iraq and Afghanistan, okay? But in terms of the people and the people that they use, it's all the neoconservatives, you see. So there's nothing, it's the neoconservatives are not the committee on the present danger, and that committee is long gone. And I mean, it existed, it's been resurfaced again, another story. Things never really go away, right? The people didn't die or anything like that, but just organizationally and in terms of policy formation and fitting that policy into the reality of U.S. military doctrine. So that's why the Project for a New American Century, the primary, you know, the Crystals, et cetera, the Kagans, right, their think tank, they were saying back in the 90s, like, basically, if we don't have a U.S. military that's actually able to now then take this fracture in the Soviet Union and then actually just go in and break up the whole thing and win and win and really win, if we don't do that in this moment, we're not ever going to really win. And the other problem is that looking at the state of the military that we really have right now, this is like 1995 or something, whatever, what was the date of rebuilding America's defenses? Anyway, you know, their theory was you're going to have a new Pearl Harbor type event like 9/11. So that's a false flag. That's an own goal. And then you're going to use that to then support like a whole transformation of how we do the military and what resources we put and then our thinking of the military. Okay, all of that failed. Like, no, not the parts about the airport and the indefinite detention, the Patriot Act and all these things and warrantless search and seizure. Yeah, we got that. But in terms of, but of course, the empire, a country can make its own fucking laws or whatever, right? It can legislate itself out of existence if it wants to. The point is that geopolitically, all those things didn't serve the stated goal. Now, of course, people see these types of projects through different lenses. So if you're just a sort of like, how am I moving my money around in investments from military industrial complex companies, then you don't really fucking care if the crazy's dream is going to succeed or not. You get behind it because it's another opportunity to use war to profit massively. That's all. But the neocons really believed in this stuff. That's why they were called the crazies, because it's almost dangerous, right, to have in Washington, and I'm not saying we agree with them, right? But it's dangerous to have people that believe in anything. You know, that's only, in fact, the only thing that you could say that, you know, was interesting about these neocons is that they had ideas. And, you know, that's kind of missing. Ideas have been missing for a while. So kind of interesting about the neocons is that they had ideas, but in reality, the coming together of this group that must have maybe emerged out of the interaction between the trilateralists and the Committee on the Present Danger, I guess it makes sense that over time that this would produce the neocons. Now, the neocons use idealism as justifications for their aims, which are rooted in object realism, which is the primary contention that all realists make about idealists at the level of policy formation. Realists accuse idealists of lying to themselves and lying to their own students about what idealism really is. Does idealism produce the ideal outcome? Does idealism produce an idealist approach between states in international relations? Or does idealism produce justification for things which are actually being driven by realism and provide a kind of idealist cover for that? What would that be? Human rights, right? Things like this. So anytime that you use human rights or democracy or anything like that as a pretext for, invading or sanctions or whatever you do, that's idealism, right? But then when you look at who's benefiting from that and like what the actual goals are, you go, oh, there's a realism here. Oh, there's no fucking such thing as idealism in IR. There are honest people who are honest about power, and that looks very ugly on paper, but it's very liberating. And then you have people who lie about power and tell fanciful stories that justify real abuse and get us to think that, you know, basically get you tilting at windmills, turns you to Don Quixote. We're going to take 30 seconds, and then we're going to come back and wrap up for you. And we're going to go through a couple of news items. I'm going to look real quickly and see if somebody snuck in a comment, even though I didn't know. Fortunately, no. Good. And we'll wrap up. I'll be back in 30 seconds. And then I kind of just want to run down the events with what we're talking about and then pull up for some headlines and then look at when we think the Russian media and Russian Telegram is going to change its approach and kind of start to, in the place of our imagination, see that this big offensive, how this is going to pop off. All right, so we'll be back in 30 seconds. Stay tuned. All right, and we are back. So, you know, this was this attack on the nuclear power plant, you know, trying to make Russia look like it was a nuclear terrorist. This is a redo of Chernobyl, and it looked like the situation at Chernobyl and what was actually communicated, not that we got this memo, but what was communicated between the powers in this conflict was that they were going to destroy Chernobyl. The Ukraine was going to launch a suicidal and destroy Chernobyl. Okay. And the thing is that, why are we saying this? Well, we said that at the time, dude. I said that when it was happening, like, oh, this is a false flag. They're going to do the thing. So that this would be happening, they're trying it again. Okay. The thing is that Russia is not going to withdraw from Zaporizhia. So its approach to the information war is going to be different. And they're not willing to, you know, let this one up. Because you had, like, the UN Secretary General, Guterres, he has stopped short of making any meaningful statement about this. Both ways. He hasn't blamed Russia, but he also hasn't said, you know, who launched the attack. Right? It's this mystery. It's an interesting language can construct this. George Orwell talked about this destruction of language. He was partly guilty of this, but he at least described the process in 1984. And language is certainly being destroyed when we use the passive tense. Like if we say it got leveled, well, we've removed from that to say that it was attacked, that Zaporizhia was attacked. It doesn't say who did the attacking. And there are some languages where it is the awkwardness of that subjectless event in the syntax of the language, of the syntax of the sentence, it's much more awkward to try to present it. And the English language is particularly attuned to managerial newspeak. Not for nothing do people go learn business English. And while Spanish is the most spoken language in the world among people speaking the language of their home, English is the most acquired second language in the world, and most people learn English. And most English tutors for people who now speak English but want to speak business English learn the phrases and expressions of customer service and management. And that embedded in that is the destruction of language, a destruction of language that has occurred specifically as, I don't think any inherent reasons, okay? But as the English language became the language of empire, an empire that was based in Britain, England, and the U.S., what that has done, an interesting thing in language, is that it has even, I want to say, geopoliticized language, because there are other languages where the people maybe feel like they're in resistance to, you know, global Anglo dominance or some crazy fucking shit like that or whatever. And there's even language theory that, like, you know, that French and Spanish and or these other languages don't contain, or Italian, trying to make these bureaucratic statements where there's no subject operating on an object, like the passive, like the completely passive tense, which is almost unique in English. People even try to make it be that that other countries have almost made language into resistance, you know, to empire or whatever, you know. That doesn't mean that the Spanish or the French haven't had empires. It just means that, like, when the bureaucratic revolution was happening and, you know, all these changes to language, English was the language when that happened, you know, that's all. But I think more crazy than that, and what's really startling right now with language is that you had a whole generation of or two of people raised in the U.S. and the English-speaking world. I can only speak to that, you know, really intimately. Who believed that euphemisms were magical spells that trumped the law. And this is because of the way that, again, English language has allowed to be abused by corrupt courts. And in effect, using the technicalities of codes against the aims to which the whatever harm that the code was constructed to prevent or mitigate, you see. And in fact, to make all discussion about law be a discussion about the technicalities and not the reason that the law came into being in the first place. We're seeing the same thing happen with organizations, with the Olympics. Why did the Olympics come into the existence in the first place? Was it the games of Friends of Democracy, or did you have Nazis and communists and monarchs and kings and dudes with one eye and fucking scepters and shit, right? It was crazy, and it was the Olympics. It showed that there was a sense and a sanity that was larger than the differences that fucking one-eyed crazy dictators with scepters and Gandhi and whatever, like, all had with each other. You see what I'm saying? Like, take it to this cartoon level, because they're taking it to this cartoon level, making everything which exists that has a foundation, that there's a reason that these things came into being. It was never impossible for the U.S. to make an organization for its friends. They've always done that. That's why you have NATO and things like that. G7. Okay. And it's fine to, you know, among the people that you're lining up as your little stooges or your friends or whatever, it's fine to play your little game about who's invited, who's not invited, whose invitation got rescinded. It's the way that the U.S. does these things. You would think that you were watching, you know, like Heathers or Jawbreakers or something like that. You would think you were watching like Beverly Hills 90210, Melrose Place type of stuff. Like very, 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 very 90s drama. And not statesmanship. It's really weird. Like, we're not showing up, or like, you're not invited. Like, this is very weird stuff, you know? So we're walking out. And you can do these games, and they can work, and you can even do them, and you can do these stunts and games in these international organizations that you've all agreed are inviolable and you're always going to be members of. And it made sense to hash these things out in the public view and stuff, to the extent that people followed whatever the speeches, you know, people, you have some very famous speeches given at the UN, Castro, more recently Gaddafi, you know, in the past, or there was just many great moments in UN history, man. I tell you, you know, whatever you think of these people and whatever their policies were at home, the things that they landed, you know, at the UN were gold. I mean, stuff that Gaddafi or Castro said at the UN was gold. You know, whatever else about them, you know, be that as it may. But, you know, this attack on the nuclear facility, my concluding thoughts are that while it's not wrong to consider it like, in a sense, a distraction or like a ruse or something like this, you always have to bear in mind that it may be serving as something like that, but involving things that we're not aware of, number one. Number two, when you look at how the West collectively is engaged in this nuclear terrorism, people are no longer blind to the hypocrisy for the attackers themselves, right, to then use the language of the victim and then accuse people discussing the issue of being victim blamed. Like, this is very strong, very multiple levels of abuse. Okay. You have to know these things and recognize them. Okay. Some people in their life journey are coming out of oppressive traditional structures. And what I mean by that is there was nothing oppressive about the traditional structure. What we're talking about is abusive people, maybe in family, in community, okay, who use these rules, whatever they were, but we're talking about the traditionally based ones, as the place to leverage their abuse onto others. That they're kind of the one that kind of interprets the rules, and they're kind of the one that enforces the rules and things like that. Now, because of that, many people think that the authoritarianism was inherent to the ideas, to the tradition, and not to the individual utilizing it towards their own end. So then they think that, oh, if we're just, you know, liberal and open and horizontal and against patriarchy, then we are the good people. We are the, and we're, everything we're going to do is going to be based in freedom, and all of our interactions with people are going to be free, because we, not being them, are incapable of those things by virtue of our existence. And the opposite is true. It's actually by virtue of existence that we are all capable of these things. And that has totally confused our political discourse. The Russians have had control over this, have had control over this nuclear power plant for a while. And I think since April or March. And even then, people were saying there's going to be a false flag, there's going to be something, something. I think overall, there's been success in here. And what do I mean by that is that they were not able to use assets and do subterfuge or something on the spot. They actually had to attack the location physically, militarily, which means that all the forensics and all of the things like that can't justify their story. So they're relying upon the media not covering the story, but just covering the headline. And that's been a fallback. You know, we see them do that in the information war time and time again, and we see them do that so often that we start to think that this is their preferred method or their preferred angle. And I will tell you, it is not. This is a compromised position. It's not good for them. Trying to gaslight and succeed in the messaging with whoever will believe it, okay, is infinitely more powerful than giving up and not trying to float a lie at all. So all of the incentive in the world is on their side to continue to lie, because it's just like doing anything. If you do something that has a 5% chance of succeeding, right, versus not doing it, you have an infinitely higher chance of succeeding, no matter what the chances are, versus not doing it at all. And so likewise, carpe diem, the cabal will just, they always continue forward and roll out with the lie of the story, even though contained within the lie are all the vestigial elements of the real operation that fail to fucking materialize. I'll say that again. Embedded within their narrative about whatever shit they're floating right now, embedded within that, if you look, you will find the forensic, right, leftovers of an other plan where all that shit that makes no fucking sense actually would have made sense. The reason that they go forward, one of the reasons that they go forward with the lie is because, well, all the effort into building the lie has already been constructed. I mean, it's already been placed. And then there's always going to be enough people. There are always going to be people who believe it, which is more than the zero people who would believe it if they said nothing out there, if they floated nothing out there to be believed. So there's always a benefit to lie for them. Number two, as we've talked about before, why even in counterinsurgency, insurgency, color revolutions, and things like that, that the stages of these things, they go by escalation, meaning harder to organize, but harder for the other side to take, right? They escalate. So there are each step is based upon, it's like a stairs escalating in organizing and insurgency and counterinsurgency. Talking about ground campaign, winning hearts and minds, ideological domain, full spectrum domination. You go into a population, you identify the gangs, identify the leaders, you identify, right? Okay. Now, what you want in a population, right, is that the story that you're telling them and the things that happen are the same thing. But you've put all this effort into organizing them. You've escalated and you've escalated, right? You've all these different moving parts, okay? Then one critical step of this fails to materialize, okay? But if you start to act like your ship is sinking, then everybody bails on you. But if you just don't flinch when that critical thing failed to materialize, and you're still like, yeah, all systems are go, like all the other plans are forward, okay, then that maintains confidence, or it mitigates against a complete confidence vacuum that would emerge, okay? So the plan to destroy the world and make World War III happen in your life now failed to materialize around 2012, 2013. It's so wild that it's almost like we're like on a different fucking timeline or something like that, okay? Something happened 2012, 2013. I talked about with the, Mother Mariam of the Cross in Syria came forward with the evidence that the entire gas attack, chemical attack was fake. Irrefutable evidence. And then, as if the sky had opened up, and as if touched on the nose by an angel, a very otherwise forgettable, normally corrupt politician, Prime Minister, failed to follow American orders and launch airstrikes from the Royal Air Force. They put the vote instead bizarrely. They put it as a vote to Parliament bizarrely. And then bizarrely, even those members of labor who couldn't wait to vote for the next war credit didn't find a good reason to attack. Even those Tories who think that everyone outside of England is a dictator, couldn't put it down on a vote to attack Syria. That is the date. That is the date that will go down in history. That is the date that the world completely changed. It was, I guess, 10 years ago. The empire has been on the run, has been in an overt, you know, noticeable, you know, palpable state of collapse. Syria went completely upside down for them. Yes, they damaged it. Yes, it's not what it was. But they are far from their aim. This was supposed to create... I know it's a little bit weird, but we as people tend not to appreciate all the bad things that didn't happen because we're problem solvers and we don't stop to smell the roses of the catastrophes that we averted. We tend to focus on the imperfection of the present moment, and we tend to then use that as how we put together the things we want to change. And the things that we don't notice are the things that didn't happen. And yet, many things, we tend to think about all the great things that could have happened, and yet we don't look at all of the bullets that we dodged. We are living, no doubt, in the best of all possible worlds. This is the best timeline, and you are in it. For you, your opportunity is an open invitation. There are no limits. There is a cabal who have tried to define what is the purpose of human civilization, what are our limits, which direction should we be going. They have looked at our own bodies and said that these should be like non-biological. They've looked up at the blackness of space and said, this is where we should be looking, not at each other, not at ourselves, in the critical sense of looking at yourself in the mirror, but instead look at all of these ways that can legitimize your outrage. We have caused all of these problems for you, made you think that anger is the right response to the things that we've done to you, which is another thing that we've done to you, and then point to people that you're allowed to be angry at. Then we can defund the police and then just have a bunch of people running around getting text messages of wanted posters of who it's allowed to attack when you see them in public. It'll just be like the you know, the people that run around in rural parts of Iran, like making sure that girls' hairlines don't show. It'll be like that. And, you know, Iran can justify it. I mean, they have rural parts that, I guess, whatever, people are, that's where they're at in their, you know, with their life, and that's great for them if they're into it. But if that's not how you want to live, maybe you're not in Iran, maybe you're not in a no-go zone in Germany or France or England. What these technocrats propose is no different. It's just different in style, in form, but not in substance. They want to impose a new theocracy because only a theocracy can get you paying into their dream without any tangible results. Their religion requires carbon credits and a cap and trade system so that the developing parts of the world stop developing. So that for every meter of development that they make, they have to pay a meter back to the old colonial imperial core, City of London, Wall Street. Backed by the Vatican, and much, much more. And yet, in the first stage of our education, when we first learn about the true nature of the world, it's perhaps demoralizing. And I can see where a lot of Black people come from in their initiation into reality. It can be hard, especially if you come from a background and things were maybe kind of hunky-dory or Leave It to Beaver. And so the realities of what actually many people experience more regularly, you were not aware of these things. And this idea that, you know, of wars for profit or institutional corruption are shocking. I think the thing of greater interest is how you can be aware of all these things and know all of these things and then see through them where all the answers lie and where the path for liberation is. So I think this is the thing to meditate on as we conclude. Certainly all these events right now are mind-blowing. The raid on Trump, just don't think, I hope that this is connected the right way for you. Don't misunderstand that raiding Trump is not about two people with power who don't get along or something like that. And these are just like the little bullshits like between Saudi princes, like calling the cops on each other. No. This is actually about the world war that did not occur, how Trump colluded with Russia to prevent a nuclear holocaust or something like this, okay? That's what this whole story is about. So you cannot disconnect, in the broad sense, Trump from the nuclear power plant terrorist situation, from the outcome of this conflict in Ukraine, from November elections again. You can't separate these things. If you don't, you don't have to like Trump's, you know, grab him by the pussy and all these other things, okay? If you don't understand that, you know, right or wrong, indifferent, whatever, what they were doing, what Trump was doing with Russia, prevented the conflict in Syria from escalating far beyond what an idiot like John Kerry and his deconfliction talks, or whatever, I call them surrender talks. They had to surrender in Syria. U.S. surrendered airspace and more. And then when Trump comes in, recognizing, now people may say, oh, but the Russians have the yes, recognizing the reality on the ground is the difference between the Trump foreign policy and the neocon agenda. The neocons being this post Committee on the Present Danger versus
trilateralist approach to the buy-in on the empire.
Those are my final words on it then for today on that. This is going to be, let's see, August 12th. Very good. It'll be up on the drive momentarily. All right, peace. I'm out.